This is the takeaway for Thursday, December 7th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I literally drove around down to the avenue to see what was going on. I had no idea where the fire was, why there was smoke, why it smelled.
We didn't worry too much until about 3:30 when the embers started coming in our yards, and you could see over there kind of the red and the smoke, and so that's when we left.
The winds changed, and within 20 minutes, I looked out my bedroom window, and I could see all of the glow and the flame from the fire.
3:30, somewhere there's no more water. If there's no more water, whatever's burning is going to keep on burning. There's no firefighters because there's no water.
What do you pack in that moment? I'm like throwing shoes and things that don't really matter, and I just wanted to get out of the house, so we just left basically with just the clothes on our back and the Christmas presents that we just shopped for.
You're hearing the voices there of Southern Californians surrounded by flames. Fires burning in and around Los Angeles. Some of that testimony comes to us from KNBC-TV. Wildfires have been raging around L.A. since Monday, fanned and spread by dry Santa Ana winds. One fire shut down the northbound 405 freeway near Bel Air on Wednesday. And earlier this week, a massive fire in Ventura County jumped the 101 freeway and reached the Pacific Ocean. The fires have burned more than 100,000 acres, forced more than 100,000 people to evacuate their homes. John Sepulvedo is host of the California Report from KQED. He's in Ventura County, about an hour north of Los Angeles.
So I'm in the town of Ojai, which is about 7,500 people, and the situation is the smoke is thick. In the distance, you hear helicopters, you hear the metallic chatter of radio hum from firefighters being dispatched from one place to the other. Unfortunately, it's been one of the saddest sounds I've ever heard, trapped coyotes on this mountain. And it's not just the coyotes that are trapped. Everything in the town of Ojai right now is surrounded by flame. And that is not a hyperbole, not an exaggeration. There's flame forming a 360-degree radius of this town. Now, there are still ways to get out. For example, I'm perfectly safe. I can get on the roadway and get out. But the concern is that as the winds again begin to shift, that this fire could spread.
Are firefighters in the area able to keep up with the spread right now in your area?
Yeah, they are. And I mean, it's almost like they're superhuman. I saw firefighters who were literally stopping in the Vons parking lot, the supermarket parking lot out here, and sleeping for 15 minutes while their engines are blaring, while sirens were going on, and then getting up and going back to the front lines. They have staked a perimeter, and they've been able to essentially, despite winds in the 50-mile-per-hour range overnight, they have been able to keep the flames from coming inside the town of Ojai. The question is how long. We are, as a state, strapped for resources because of all the fires. There were deadly, as you know and your listeners know, there were deadly fires in north of the Bay Area. There were fires today, and we're seeing reports that there are more fires throughout the Southland in Los Angeles and potentially other places. So there's a real question of how long they can sustain this effort. And there's a great fear because we know that the worst of the weather is not here yet.
John, you're there in Ojai, but can you step back a little bit, if you would, and give us a sense of the scope and the severity of these fires across Southern California?
Yeah, and right now we got a car passing by, and this is actually a great small example. I've been in Ojai many, many times, and this is a very small, quiet mountain town, and I have never seen in my life the amount of truck traffic like that's just passing me right now. We're talking water tankers, bucket trucks, fire engines, other trucks. I don't even know what they do, all of these trucks, except try to keep the fire out and try and keep the power on and keep people safe. That is becoming a sight throughout California on the ground. In the air, if you were to watch a time-lapse video of satellite images of not just California but the West, you would see that for most of this year, there has been smoke coming from some part of the West. And at times like right now, multiple smoke events that are just creating these huge plumes of smoke throughout the air. So we, at least for this year, are seeing something radically different, which is a never-ending fire season.
there were some really shocking images coming out of the fires, burning along major highways, people driving on the 405 and the 101 freeways, posting videos, flames all around them as cars just went down the road. What are authorities saying about the danger of these fires directly to people right now? And where they could go as the winds pick up?
So right now, where I'm at in the town of Ojai, there is not an area that is not under some type of evacuation order. Go to the next little town that's over, evacuation order. Go to the town in Ventura County after that, evacuation order. Look north to Santa Barbara, the concerns, evacuation orders getting ready. In Los Angeles, more evac orders. I mean, the play of the day is evacuation. The question is whether people are heeding that. And what we're seeing is people are staying for either two reasons. One, in Los Angeles, they didn't know that there was a fire danger. I mean, where Bel Air is a long way from where I'm standing right now. And yet there's a lot of speculation that embers from the fire here in Ventura County are what started the fires in Los Angeles. There's concern that fires in Los Angeles could spread down 90 miles south to San Diego. So part of it is people don't know, they don't realize that just because a fire is not around them doesn't mean that there can't be one that night. The other thing is stubbornness. People aren't leaving because they want to protect their home. It's everything they have. And they believe that they can beat this fire. And we're hearing, one of the things we're hearing, Todd, that's just kind of insane to hear, is people are saying, well, you know, my family's lived here for generations. We've beat fires before. And every official I speak to, whether on the fire side or the weather service side, are really clear in that they say, these are not your grandfather's fires. These are not going to be treated the same. They're not going to act the same. They pose a much greater threat than they did a generation ago. So that's one of the reasons that officials are concerned that people aren't heeding these evac warnings.
Are people in general starting to get the sense that fire season is different, that it's hotter, that it's longer, and that it's more dangerous than it used to be?
I think on some like deep level, there's an understanding of that. But when I've actually asked people this question, you know, it's kind of like earthquakes. Like, they don't really believe that it can happen, even though it's predicted. And a lot of times, you were talking earlier about people driving through the highway. It's almost like we're learning to live with it as opposed to being shocked by the state of it. I'm a native Californian, proud native California, grew up in Southern California. I've seen some crazy wildfires in my day. This, what I've seen this year is, I don't even have words for it compared to the experiences I've had before. This is nuts.
John Sepulvedo of the California Report in Ventura County for us. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When fires tore across Northern California earlier this year, shortages in the construction industry meant an even greater reliance on undocumented workers. And the same is true now in Houston, Texas, rebuilding after Hurricane Harvey. Back in August, the storm caused more than $180 billion worth of property damage. And as the city pieces itself back together, day laborers now make up a major part of the city's workforce.
These are workers who are hired by the day for a wide range of construction and landscaping projects. They're paid by the hour, but all too often not paid. And it's a largely immigrant workforce.
That's Nick Theodore you're hearing there. He's a professor of urban planning at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Several weeks after Hurricane Harvey hit in Houston, Nick Theodore surveyed over 360 day laborers in Houston. Many are undocumented immigrants, but they're still covered by the same employment law as everybody else. Still, Nick found a pattern of abuse and, in many cases, theft.
More than one out of four day laborers just in the last month alone worked but was not paid for that work. The average wage theft was over $200. And so what we have is a situation where workers are accepting work, going in, doing difficult, often hazardous work, and at the end of the day or at the end of several days, not being paid at all for that work.
Now, what are the requirements under Texas law, Houston municipal law, if any, or any other level of jurisdiction for safety standards, safety instructions for day laborers?
You know, I think the real problem is that especially during a crisis, health and safety and many of our other rules just go out the window. And so workers, homeowners, business owners are not prepared for disasters. And when a disaster hits, it's not unusual for a homeowner or a business to look to the day laborer and say, what do we need to do? So we're really lacking in our disaster preparedness, especially as it pertains to worker health and safety.
Nick, you seem to be describing a situation here where the incentives all point to people needing work done. A disaster's taking place. They need cleanup. They need repainting. That's easy to understand. They turn to day laborers, but day laborers, as you said, might be undocumented. And then it's easy to see why they don't have the authorities on their side.
Sure. But during an emergency situation, we often have to suspend a lot of our rules, and immigration rules in particular could be suspended here. You know, I think what we have is a situation where families and business owners in Houston have to get their lives back on track. And there are widespread labor shortages in the construction industry. And day laborers become a key group of second responders that do the day-to-day work that helps cities like Houston recover.
But what happens typically if a day laborer doesn't get paid, has their wages stolen, or gets injured on the job in a workplace safety situation? Do they have recourse up the chain? Where do they go?
Sure. The Texas Workforce Commission is the agency that's charged with ensuring that workers are being paid. But unfortunately, in our survey, we found not a single day laborer knew of the Texas Workforce Commission. And what this suggests is that that commission needs to do a lot more to get out and do outreach into informal hiring sites to ensure that day laborers have an avenue through which they can recover their wages.
How big of a problem has this been in Hurricane Harvey in Houston and the aftermath there versus Katrina in New Orleans? Have those two disasters been compared?
Sure. I think we're seeing very similar situations. In the case of Hurricane Katrina, you had a large number of immigrant workers moving into the city to help in the repair. The difference here in Houston is that most are long-term residents of that city. I'm talking about, you know, two-thirds living in Houston for 5 years or more, and many more than a third, 10, 20, even 30 years in the city. So we're talking about Houston residents who are day laborers, who are undocumented immigrants, but they are Houston residents over the long term, and they are these second responders who are helping the city recover from the disaster.
So what's the bottom line here for you, Nick? Houston needs to recover, as you said. Labor is short. People are going to need to work. They want to work, and they should work. What needs to happen?
I think the bottom line is that the city of Houston, the state of Texas, and the United States as a whole needs to understand that in the advent of a natural disaster, it's often immigrant workers and undocumented immigrant workers in particular who are moving into some of these dangerous jobs, these jobs that are necessary to have families and these cities recover from disaster. And we need to come to terms with this because this has been the pattern not just in Houston, but in New York with Hurricane Sandy, in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina. This is the way in which recoveries are being undertaken.
Nick Theodore, professor of urban planning at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We go now to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the ongoing trials of accused 9/11 conspirators. Another round of pretrial hearings is underway this week, all part of the government's case against five men accused of plotting and supporting the September 11th attacks. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty for alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his co-defendants. Now, this is the 26th session of pretrial hearings in this military commission since Mohammed and the other defendants were indicted over 5 years ago. Correspondent Arun Roth is with our partner station WGBH. He's on the U.S. base at Guantanamo Bay this week.
The better part of this week, it's been taken up by a motion regarding one of the five defendants. This is Mustafa al-Hassawi. He's been referred to sometimes as the money man for the 9/11 operation. His lawyer, Walter Ruiz, is arguing on his behalf that the military commissions don't have jurisdiction to try him here in the war court. So it's kind of a big issue.
They don't have jurisdiction. Why?
Well, Hassawi's team says that they're going by the government's own rules. That's the criteria set by the actual Military Commissions Act of 2009. According to that act, the prosecution has to prove that a defendant participated in or supported hostilities or that they were part of al-Qaeda when the attack took place. Now, what Hassawi's team is arguing is that the U.S. was not properly at war with al-Qaeda on September 11th, 2001, at least, you know, not by the formal rules of war, as the court might take it. They say that the war didn't start until the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October of 2001, and therefore the court does not have jurisdiction. And the burden here is on the prosecution to prove that.
still, it's pretty amazing, Arun, that the court is still arguing over pretrial motions, 26 of them, as you said, even at this date, even so long after they were first taken to Guantanamo Bay 5 years after 9/11.
Yeah, it's been definitely dragging on for a long time now. And so much of that time has been spent dealing with the issue of torture. The defense attorneys for these five men have been trying to get as much information as they can about what happened to these men in CIA custody. They were all in CIA custody. You know, we know famously Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded extensively. And more has been coming out over the years. You know, the Senate report came out 2 years into this thing, which all of a sudden gave them more information. The point of that is they're trying to get as much detail about that as possible with an eye towards mitigation. Assuming that they are convicted, they can make an argument that the treatment of these men was so heinous, basically, that the government has lost the moral authority to execute them.
You know, Arun, 26 pretrial hearings, years and years of this deciding whether a military court can try these accused terrorists, makes you wonder why they're just not in a federal courtroom somewhere in New York City.
Yeah, and you know, Todd, the funny thing about that, of course, President Obama did try to move the case to a federal court in New York City, and there was a huge political outcry over that, and they ended up moving the case back down here to Guantanamo. What's interesting right now, though, I got to say, is that you remember during the campaign, President Trump promised to load Guantanamo up with bad dudes. That hasn't been happening. There have actually been a number of foreign terror suspects who've been picked up, and none of them have been sent to Guantanamo. One in particular, one you might say was a very bad dude, an individual who was allegedly involved in the Benghazi attack. He was picked up by U.S. commandos in Africa in October, and then a week later, he shows up in a federal court in Washington, D.C. on U.S. soil. So strangely, it seems like the Trump Sessions approach to prosecuting terrorists is going with that Obama holder approach, basically that, you know, go with a federal court because they know how to prosecute terrorists and it won't take them 20 odd years to finally get to a trial.
The 26th session of pretrial hearings at Guantanamo Bay, a U.S. military commission trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other men accused of involvement in the 9/11 attack. Arun Roth with WGBH. Thanks so much, Arun.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. We've been talking all week with some of the women who say they were harassed and bullied by John Hockenberry. Farai Chidea came to the program as a guest host in 2009. She says John pulled her aside one day, told her she should not come to the show just to work as a diversity hire, and then he told her she should lose weight. Farai went to New York Public Radio president Laura Walker.
What really did put a dagger through my heart was when I went to Laura. I went straight to the top, and I said, this is what happened. And she said, it's horrifying, but with a certain, I'm just going to be blunt here, theatrical finality that sort of implied this is not to be discussed again.
Farai Chidea is the author of The Episodic Career and a program officer for journalism at the Ford Foundation, which has supported WNYC. She talks about the emotional and financial consequences of what happened and then about some lessons for media and journalism.
I'm someone who now is a program officer, which means I give away grants. And one of my first jobs as a grant maker was to give away some clustered grant making around Puerto Rico. And one of those grants went to WNYC's newsroom because there's excellence here. There are people here who are doing amazing work and I support them. So there's no question about that. And I'm very pragmatic about this industry. This industry needs to reform. This station needs to reform. The whole world needs to reform. So this is not, we're going to get into the weeds a bit, but let's not forget the big picture. So one thing I want to make clear is that I knew this was a hostile work environment walking in the door. I had been the host of NPR's News and Notes, a solo host. It was terminated. The whole show was terminated with two other shows during the sort of, you know, epic Great Recession budget cutbacks at NPR. But in any case, I needed a job. I had a certain amount of layoff money that, you know, you get just as a member of the union. And I knew about Adora's NDA, not from Adora, but from multiple other parties, because journalism is a small world. And when you're a woman of color, especially, people warn you when you're getting into a trap. But because of the limited number of options for people of color in media, especially, and also for women, sometimes your best choice is a hostile work environment. So I came in here knowing what I was up against. So strike one, I came in the door knowing that John went rogue on a regular basis, that WNYC likely had paid a settlement to Adora Udoji to keep her quiet. And when John made his comments to me that I've talked about before, where he pulled me aside after a staff meeting where he was argumentative for no reason with no editorial purpose, and, you know, said that I shouldn't stay on as just a diversity hire and I should go lose weight, it wasn't that those comments were unexpected. What really did put a dagger through my heart was when I went to Laura. I made an appointment. A few days later, I went to her office and I said, this is what happened.
You're talking about Laura Walker, CEO of WNYC.
Correct. I went straight to the top and I said, this is what happened. And she said, it's horrifying, but with a certain, I'm just going to be blunt here, theatrical finality that sort of implied this is not to be discussed again. And I was like, that's warning shot number two. I'm out of here. So I, you know, kind of got myself together over the next couple weeks and then gave notice and left. And I told people who I trusted about it. And we've kept this confidence. And I didn't tell Adora, but people, other women of color in the industry also knew. So I want to make it clear that a hostile work environment in media is kind of de facto the environment that people of color expect. This is just understand that. Process that for a second, Todd.
I'm processing it, and there's something new in what you're saying to me, because you and I have never discussed this either, for you left your fill-in hosting slot here because of the hostile work environment. It wasn't
correct.
Incidental.
No. I was willing to give management a chance to resolve it, and when I saw that that wasn't happening, I was like, constitutionally and emotionally, I'm not willing to put up with this. I need a paycheck. And this did damage me financially. We should really also talk about the financial damages done to people of color. There's a massive wealth gap in America, and employment discrimination contributes to it. Because when I left WNYC with no plan B, I spent down those layoff savings I was trying not to spend. I went into credit card debt. I mean, the game is real.
And has bottom line consequences that you're talking about that couldn't be more real, which is no job.
Correct.
In a place you can't work.
Exactly. And it's also that this station dominates this market. So I've come back many times as a fill-in host, as, you know, an analyst, as someone who's done special projects, because there's excellence here. And again, that's something that I think a lot of people don't understand. It's like, why would you go back to your abusive husband? It's like, because he has the only place that I can find a roof over my head. And so when the media ecosystem is deeply poisoned, people are forced to make hard decisions. And I think we're finally reaching a point where people say we deserve a better ecosystem. And that's why I want us to speak, although I'm speaking about what happened to me here at WNYC, this is not just a WNYC issue. And I'm not excusing WNYC. I think I'm being pretty blunt. But I want to make clear that this is a systemic issue and we all have a role in fixing it.
I've talked about this with other guests throughout the week because the dynamic that developed here is Adora Udoji was a host and fell away. Farai Chidea was a fill-in host and fell away. Celeste Headlee was a host and fell away. And after all of this, after all three of these women fell away, all three of these black women fell away, to be more specific, there was one person left standing each time. That was John Hockenberry.
Well, yeah. I mean, of course. And I will say, Todd, that you too were left standing, not in the same way, and I'm not impugning your motives, but I do think that the reality is that I expect he treated you very differently than he treated the three of us. And I expect that legitimately you probably didn't see some of the same behaviors, but I'm the kind of person who does deep listening just all the time. I'll talk to, you know, anybody. I have the most fascinating conversations, and I learn something about immigration, about community gardens, about marriages, and if people just talk to each other more as human beings, they would have been able to put this together. But when people are working in an environment of fear and silence, they can't afford to be human beings, and they can't afford to show any cracks in the armor, and that's when you have things like this that go on for years.
I think there was a lot of defensiveness around here in those years because a lot of the environment was toxic. I never co-hosted with John very much, spottily, maybe once or twice when I was coming up. And John bullied a lot of people, I want to say, not just the co-hosts. And I think you
probably... Yeah, not just women.
Right. Not just women. And I think you probably know that. Did he treat me differently? John never bullied me. I said this earlier in the week. I questioned whether it was because I was another white male. How could it not be? I don't know quite what to make of that.
I think what we make of it is change. And that means systemic change in the newsroom and systemic change in the American workplace. I wrote a book called The Episodic Career that came out in 2016. And part of the reason I wrote it was because I had a lot of stuff that I'd processed privately about what it meant to be employed in an age of anxiety. And I have a whole chapter on employment discrimination, reporting, and redress. And essentially, it says it's very hard to get your issues redressed when you report them. And I'm hoping that if, you know, I'm not intending to rewrite the book or revise the book, but if there were a mythical revised edition, I would hope that chapter would read totally differently. Like, HR departments are proactive in da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, we need to just redesign. And part of my work now involves looking at things like the work of Iris Bonet, who's a professor at Harvard. She's at the Kennedy School, and she gave a great talk at South by Southwest last year about gender design for workplaces. And she says, stop trying to de-bias people, you know, and tell everybody, you know, you must like black people, you must like women. Just design workplaces where biased people can do less damage, you know? And so she's been a proponent of symphony auditions happening behind screens. So people are judged on their musicianship, not their gender, not their race, not whether they have tight abs. You know, like, there are ways to design workplaces to deal with the fact that human beings are often biased and sometimes really disagreeable.
Another way is to have more people of color being the bosses and in leadership so that the people below them have, sure, they may harbor personal biases, but those biases will be treated with more proactivity and will be treated differently than if it's, frankly, just white dudes leading a place.
Well, here's what I would say. I think that WNYC has a management team that is both male and female. Gender alone will not create equality, nor will race alone. It takes people who are committed to actually doing the work. And I do agree that adding more managers of color and more female managers is key, but what's really key is having committed management with strategies, the willingness to let go of people who don't conform to workplace protocols, and stopping protecting people who are for one reason or the other favored, but who simply don't live up to acceptable code of conduct. I mean, we're living in a time where this is happening across industries, and I think it's because we have tolerated behavior for so long. I'm almost flummoxed where to go, but let me give you a story. I have friends of all ages. One of my friends who's in her 80s, who's a former reporter, when I told her about what was going on, you know, in these new revelations about the past at WNYC, told me, oh yeah, when I was a reporter, I was a freelancer because when I would go into the office with my stories, when the editors would ask you to go to a hotel in the afternoon, I would just leave and go back home. So we've come a long way, baby. You don't have to go into the hotel room with the editors anymore. But it's like emotional labor. Women and people of color have been expected to relieve the tension of men like John Hockenberry all the time. Like, we can be the whipping post. And I just think, like I said, I wasn't willing to sacrifice my own health and well-being for that. But it was a financial cost and also emotional cost, because I think, like Kristen, who spoke on The Takeaway, there was this sense of guilt. You know, I said, you know, who did I leave behind? Now, I thought I left behind people who were bullied. I never thought I left behind people who were sexually assaulted or touched. I didn't see that coming. And all of us have a little piece of the puzzle until we start putting the puzzle together.
Farai, you've been on the inside of the show as a host, as a guest, and I assume occasionally you're a listener, at least I hope so.
Oh, of course.
And part of the mission of this show, in fact, the entire mission of this show, whether official or not, is diverse voices, voices from people of color. Even if we're covering regular old news tax bill, we make an effort to include diverse voices on the show. It's what we do. There's a real clash and a disconnect with what we try to put out in the world through our broadcast and what happened here on the inside with the team.
I, of course, am coming from a very different perspective where I think one of the things that takes down a lot of women and people of color in journalism is what I call intellectual belittlement, where your ideas are just never good enough from inception through execution. And I was just raised by stubborn people and born into a family where my parents met in graduate school of communications at Syracuse and ran a newspaper in Zambia before I was born. So I just kind of had enough ego in a healthy way. So when people diminished my ideas that I knew were good, I was just like, to heck with you. And that's the only reason that I stayed in the business for 27 years. But from my perspective, the story ideas and the story executions of women and people of color in media in general have been largely dismissed. And I think that's one reason why we saw some really lacking coverage of the 2016 election. And let me just point out as well that in before I came to the Ford Foundation, I was at Harvard Shorenstein Center doing research on the media. And I asked 15 news organizations to give me the race and gender compositions of their political 2016 political reporting teams. Only a third of them actually gave me the numbers. Journalism companies are not transparent. What we need is accountability and transparency across the board.
They are not.
The ASNE diversity survey has been struggling at points to get certain people to respond. We're not walking the walk. Like, we're doing great journalism, many of us, but our companies are not walking the walk. And if we want to survive an era of widespread civic mistrust and widespread mistrust of the news industry, we've got to shape up and walk straight.
Fry, telling stories that can be brought by women journalists, women of color, people of color into journalism, elevating those stories, not in niche markets, but at the top of the news. What does that take other than, you know, proactive promotion? Sure. But it also has to be an industry that's attractive to those people, that's attractive to those women, and that draws them in like a magnet.
Women are all around journalism.
No question.
Women have just not been promoted. So when you look at the political talk shows, it's shocking to me how male they are, both in terms of host and guests. And there's not a problem of talented women who can't be the host of political shows. It's a problem of how we think of what the host of a political show looks like, or at least what news executives might think one might look like or sound like. There's a ton of women who come in at the entry level. There is a hiccup, of course, in the pipeline during the childbearing years, but then also there's a hazing out of women at every level by behaviors like the ones we're talking about today. And so that requires, again, a commitment by leadership. And by the way, I sort of feel like we should take the diversity jersey and retire it and just bring back the meritocracy jersey. If we simply had meritocracy in America's newsrooms, we'd have very different newsrooms. But when you have things happening the way that they've been happening in America's newsrooms, including this one, you don't have a true meritocracy.
You tweeted, I think at the beginning of this week, Farai, when silence is the price of employment for people of color and women in the media, everyone pays. And I think that's part of what you're talking about.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
We pay because we lack perspective. So, for example, and I'm being frank here, I think all of my former colleagues at 538 would probably acknowledge this. There were many times where my story ideas were very different from some of the other story ideas presented. And often I took a more sociological view of how race relations played out in America and a more historical view. And not just in America, but also looking at things like immigrants in France. I wrote a piece on how immigration in France was tied to their former colonies and territories, et cetera. And that's because as a person of color with a transatlantic family that spans from Southern Africa to Baltimore to California, I am aware that race is not something that just happens overnight. During the 2016 election, the way that people traditionally thought of political coverage was spot news right now. This is what Trump's saying or Clinton's saying. For me, as an African American, I was like, oh, the racial alarm bells are going off. We're about to have a 5-alarm fire. And I kept telling people that. I was like, this is about to be a 5-alarm fire. And they're like, well, what's the evidence? And I'm like, history goes in cycles. This is what I see sociologically. You know, I keep in touch with white supremacists. I literally, like, there's this guy who's a white nationalist who I DM with and have been for months. I pay attention. And I just think that that kind of perspective gets devalued, and people who are people of color are sometimes viewed as paranoid when we bring up, there's a problem in aisle five with the race relations products, you know? And it's like, perhaps newsroom managers might listen a bit better to women and people of color.
There's this saying, this notion that if you silence people, you do a double injustice because you rob them of their ability to speak, but you rob yourself of the opportunity to hear them.
Yeah.
And to learn from them.
Yeah.
For me, that's part of the hit home message broadly of what you're saying. You know,
yes.
It robs all of us.
Right.
You should feel a responsibility to open your profession to a, diverse group of people. I'm just going to use the D word there.
That's exactly right. And to add on to it, it's really important for us to start putting some metrics around things. So one of the things I'm also working on now that I started at Harvard, and I'm also a fellow at the MIT Media Lab, but continuing my work at Ford, is looking at how metrics can help us better understand the linkages between race and gender diversity in newsrooms, the content that comes out of those newsrooms, and the revenue that comes out of those newsrooms. We can't do that right now because newsrooms won't give us numbers to do some of the basic analyses. I'm hoping that in this great era of newsroom discontent, we can finally agree to be more transparent enough to run the metrics on our own industry.
What is going to send this in the right direction and not make it a 3-month episode where 2 years from now, everybody goes, remember the fall of 2017? That was a time. Let's go do something else.
With the whole talk about transparency and accountability, newsrooms need to sort of purge their secrets in order to heal. And that also gets to questions like, what did management know and when? What did the board know and when? There's questions of nonprofit law. I was talking with a friend of mine who was a university president for over 20 years, and she said that when a lawyer working on behalf of a nonprofit is asked to generate nondisclosures by management, they also may need to flag the board about those NDAs. Did that happen? These are all legal and procedural questions that have not been answered, and I think that there deserves to be some follow-up. And also broadly in the industry, there needs to be more transparency about these processes. And sort of that level has to be dealt with, and then new systems have to be built. But you can't build new systems on top of a shaky foundation.
You mentioned non-disclosure agreements at a nonprofit organization like WNYC. You also mentioned Adore Udoji, the first co-host of The Takeaway at the top of our discussion. And both of those things bring me back to an article that Adora has written in The Guardian about her experiences with John Hockenberry. And people can see it on The Guardian's website. Adora describes being bullied, being screamed at, being interrupted, and generally being marginalized by a more experienced, more senior, and more star-studded John Hockenberry. But she ends, Farai, saying that she signed a non-disclosure agreement when she left WNYC, and that she's speaking out now at her own peril, and that she views non-disclosure agreements as a very effective tool of silence. And Adora says, this is not the time to be silenced. This is a time of transparency and accountability and a great opportunity for change.
Indeed it is. I mean, I think that's the only way we can move forward. And I think she took a very gutsy move there. It would be extremely unwise for anyone, I personally think, to try to punish her for breaking an NDA. And I think we're going to be seeing more people break NDAs because they have been used specifically to silence people.
I'm sorry that you took a risk by walking in here in the first place because we missed out. We had you around. I don't know what direction the show would have taken if you had hung around. I have no idea.
Well, I certainly enjoyed working with the staff, but I also, you know, it's taken a lot for me to learn to love myself fully, and I'm not there yet. You know, I know that in her interview with Brian Lehrer, Laura Walker mentioned that she had experienced sexual assault. I, too, am a survivor and specifically of childhood sexual abuse, but I've done the work. I think that it's your job not to inflict your pain on others and to go through a process of healing. And I ended up finding a therapeutic technique that was really useful for me called EMDR. But what that means, and the reason I'm bringing it up, is because just this weekend, for example, I was talking with someone about how this whole reliving of the WNYC experience had triggered me. And in fact, when John called me fat, it actually did trigger me because my weight is partly in reaction. It was a self-protection mechanism after childhood sexual abuse. He didn't know that. It's not his fault for that being triggering to me in that way. It was his fault for saying it. But because I've done the work on myself, my saying that gave another woman a chance to process her stuff. And so it wasn't two of us crying on each other's shoulders. I was able to stand in strength and hold her while she had a moment that she needed to have, because right now women are being triggered everywhere. And it's, again, not just women. There's some men too, but it's like right now people are really going through it emotionally. And to circle back to what you said, I appreciate you saying, you know, what would have happened if I stayed, but it was impossible for me to stay and love myself in an environment like this. At this point, I'm a bit of a steely-eyed pragmatist, and I'm really looking forward to the ways that all of us can play a role in creating a better news industry. I'm really looking to the future, and I think it can be extremely bright and better than what we've got now, because goodness knows what we've got now is challenging.
One of the conversations that we've been having around here among many, trust me, since this news broke, how do we handle it as a news organization, as a team, as a show? What do we put on the air? Who do we invite? All of those things. And part of that is what we can control as an industry and as a community coming out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, people do bad things to you. People do bad things to your community. You don't have control over that. But at the point when you do take control of it in the present, you have a responsibility to turn it
into
something good.
I think that one of the things that's important to understand is that from what we know about research on diverse teams, and you can look at some of the McKinsey research, that gender diverse leadership produces higher returns. So does racially diverse leadership in companies. And so there is a financial incentive to get this right, if nothing else. And I think there's many others, of course. But one of the things that happens in diverse teams is that there's more conflict. And this has been, I think, part of the stopping point, because instead of having a whole bunch of people who come from the same backgrounds and think the same way and say yes to the same things, you have people coming from a bunch of angles and they end up, you know, kind of wrestling over ideas. And if it's done in a productive way, that's great. And if not, it becomes World War VII. So you have to create conflict resolution systems for ideas, for people, for whatever. So there's a lot of things that just have to be done. And I still consider myself, even though I'm not in a newsroom, I still consider myself a journalist. There's a lot of things we can do as journalists to create better newsrooms, more resilient newsrooms, more fair newsrooms, and create real meritocracies. I'm actually hopeful.
Having that meritocracy and that diversity in our own shop lets you tell the real truth.
Yes.
To the people who listen to you. And that's one of the most important things for us to grasp onto as well.
Yeah.
Fry, I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you for your work. You're a steely-eyed pragmatist, and I appreciate it, as always, you coming here to share part of that vision with us, because it's valuable.
Thank you, Todd. And I just want to say that thank you to the newsroom staff here at WNYC. I know it's a challenging time, and just hang in there.
Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. Some actors wait a lifetime to land a role where they can showcase their full talent. Most never get that chance at all. For Leslie Odom Jr., the chance came at the relatively young age of 34 when he first helped rock Broadway and America as Aaron Burr in Hamilton.
Theodosia writes me a letter every day. I'm keeping her bed warm while her husband is away. He's on the British side in Georgia. He's trying to keep the colonies in line. Well, he can keep all of Georgia. Theodosia, she's mine. Love doesn't discriminate.
Leslie Odom Jr. left the cast of Hamilton back in the summer of 2016. So now the question is, what's next?
I want to walk through all the doors that were not open before the phenomenon that I was so lucky to be a part of. And so film is one of those things. Those were not things that were easy to get. They're still not. And music is the other thing.
Right now, Leslie Odom Jr. is tackling film. He's on movie screens across the country in Murder on the Orient Express, and also music. The deluxe edition of his album Simply Christmas is out now. I sat down with Leslie Odom Jr. to talk about the legacy of Hamilton and, honestly, how you do another Christmas album.
I wanted it to be like a prime quality cut of meat. You know, a really well-chosen cut of steak. I know there's vegans out there. NPR listeners, I know there's a lot of vegans. I'm talking to a lot of vegetarians right now.
They know what steak is.
But yeah, you know, really prime cut of tofu. And something that didn't need steak sauce. You didn't need, you know, salt and pepper, just that it was just perfect. And so anything that didn't need to be there was stripped away. So some songs are just piano, and some songs, of course, we have the big band feel. Every song on the record, for me, I know exactly why it's there, and felt like we managed to get to a version that felt authentic to who we were and felt necessary and classic at the same time.
Do you have a favorite on this album?
My favorite would probably be the first track and the last track. When you're making music these days, you can't assume that people are going to listen all the way down. You hope people listen all the way down, but just in case they don't, I mean, you kind of, those first three tracks are important. So the first track is my personal favorite, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. It's the Christmas song that I've been singing the longest in my life.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight.
I think we managed to make a recording of it that feels, I hope, fresh and authentic to who we are, but, you know, also feels classic and timeless in a way, something that will sound good today. And if it makes its way into the traditions of your family, that's something that'll sound good 15 years from now, too, when you put it on. So that's my favorite. And then the last track, too, I do love the Ave Maria. That was the first time that I got to sing the Ave Maria.
Ave Maria.
Done, I think, at Christmas time in the Catholic Church all the time, but it wasn't something that was around when I was growing up, but it's so beautiful.
Leslie, I read that you performed in a Baptist church when you were a kid. Is that right?
Yeah, we don't call it performing, but I did sing I sang in a Baptist church all growing up. You know, I sang in the choir, and that's where I learned about singing in key and singing in harmony and pitch and all that stuff.
Did that help propel you to the stage? Did it really have anything to do with it? A lot of kids sing in church, of course, but maybe for you it was something more.
If it does relate to performing in any way, it kind of connects, because there's dancing in church. I didn't dance in church, but there's dancers, especially these days. You know, I think they call them praise dancers and stuff in church. Mm-hmm. What it does is that it can connect art to ministry, which that jives with me. You know, Hamilton for me felt like ministry. My concerts today, I look at them like ministry, in that hopefully when I do my job right, the focus really isn't on you. The focus is the eternal and the inspiration and the magic in all of us, you know, that comes from somewhere else.
Hamilton was ministry for you. People love that show, Ministry. Why?
Because I think that the truth is ministry. For me, you know, God is love, God is truth. And so whenever you're on stage talking about either one of those two things, it feels like ministry to me. That's what it feels like. It just connected to like the deepest parts of myself, you know, like DNA level, you know, what Lynn was able to talk about in this show that was about us and wasn't about us. You know, it's about these old dead white men, but it's still kind of about us right now. And what he was able to get to felt to me as honest and as rich as anything you'd find in your Bible.
I think for a lot of Americans, Hamilton was a form of secular ministry. It was a way for people to celebrate their history in a way that they connect to in the modern way, recasting it with a diversity that it was robbed from the first time around.
You know, Broadway is difficult because you're chained to the theater. I mean, you know, you're there every single night. But now, not being out of the show, I still get the benefits of singing in my concerts. I sing songs from the show and stuff from the albums, of course. But I'm connecting with people who didn't have access to the show in New York, and they don't have access sometimes to the show in L.A. And what I'm finding out is that people's connection to it is very special to them because it's something that people my age, I'm in my mid-30s, it's something that people my age share with their parents and their children. There's not many things in our society that we share across generational boundaries like that, or across cultural or religious boundaries. You know, there's not many things that unite us around a dinner table culturally, and Hamilton was that thing for people.
What does that show mean in the Trump era?
I think it means the same thing it meant before the Trump era. People are going to have to live with the choices that they make. When there's a movement that is speaking to the worst of who we are, when there's a movement that is designed to bring about derision and separation and ugliness, you know, that just brings about the worst of who we are, and you participate in that, maybe it's not now, but I think eventually you have to answer for that. You know, karma makes you answer for that. You talk about the microphone. I do not say anything on my microphone that I would not say to the President of the United States' face. You know, I think sometimes that's the flaw of an artist, I think, or the people that have the microphones. It's like, you can say whatever you want, as long as that's something you would say to someone's face. If you had a face-to-face meeting, and would you take that tone? I think what I'm trying to say is there seems to be a pull to the worst of who we are, to our basest instincts, and you have to fight that. You have to rise above that. We can talk about anything. We can have discourse, but we got to keep it respectful, even if the President of the United States won't.
Leslie Odom Jr., you know him as Aaron Burr from the hit musical Hamilton. He's got a re-release of his Christmas album, Simply Christmas. It's out now. Merry Christmas to you, Leslie Odom Jr. Thank you for being here.
Merry Christmas. Thanks for having me.
Bells will be ringing, the sad, sad news. Oh, what a Christmas to have the blues. My baby's gone, I have no friend who wish me greeting once again.
Oh, that voice, Leslie Odom Jr. That's a great place to leave our show for today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.